Gallagher's gonna have the news.
Monday, August 19th. Los Angeles podcast.
Not Los Angeles podcast. Shit.
That's the one thing. It's either the LA podcast or LA podcast.
You had one job.
Yes. So that was Carter Rubin from the NRDC. We are selling the opportunity to just say the date at the beginning of the show going forward. And
you paid a lot.
You paid a lot.
And you screwed it up.
I hope I had the chance again. You know,
you just got to give us $10,000 more.
You can do it next week. No, Carter Rubin is sitting in this week. Scott Frazier, happy honeymoon to him.
Since we outed his wedding when he...
That's right.
We told everybody that he got married. We can tell everybody he's on.
His family.
Yeah, his family didn't even know. So congrats.
Carter, give me the bio. Give me the deets.
Born and raised in Los Angeles, circa mid-80s.
And then you left.
And then I kind of left. I went out to the far-flung LA suburb of Claremont, which is in LA County, across the street from San Bernardino County. For undergrad, I have spent some time in Seattle and in Strasbourg, France, but mostly born and raised and still living in Los Angeles, west of the 405.
But I thought you don't live in Los Angeles anymore.
Well, you technically don't live in Los Angeles.
Not city of Los Angeles, but in SoCal, in Santa Monica.
In Santa Monica.
And you're here to give us a reality check when it comes to our climate goals for this episode. So everything we talk about, you have to be like the downer.
I'm going to be the downer, but the silver lining. There's definitely going to be a silver lining to everything.
Okay.
I have a reality check on our climate goals right up top. But first, does anyone have a story from this week that they want to tell?
You have a story, Carter?
Sure. It's quick. I went to see a screening of The Doors movie last night at the Wiltern with my dad.
Doors movie.
Oliver Stone.
The movie The Doors with Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer as Jim Morrison.
Right up to the mic.
Kyle MacLachlan as Ray Manzarek. 1991 classic. Don't think it stands the test of time. But I was there.
Okay. It was bad when it came out.
That's good to know. That's validating my experience last night. But I had a great time because it was screened at the Wiltern, and it was a chance for me to take my dad to the Wiltern. He's lived in LA his whole life, but had never been there.
That's wild. Are they doing a lot of those movies?
Not that I could tell. It was a fun setup.
Just the Doors.
Hmm. And I came in knowing that I would be on this podcast, knowing that LA Woman is the theme song, and they don't play that song once in the entire movie.
Whoa.
It's one of the better songs that the Doors have, and it's bad. I think it's maybe their second best song, it's definitely not good.
Is it you singing the song?
No, everyone asked.
Everyone
that.
Asked me that, and I don't know.
I thought that you knew.
I've never asked you before.
It's Matt Bogdanow. It's just friend of the show, Matt Bogdanow, singing. It's amazing that everyone thinks of me. I don't even think it sounds like me. Okay, reality check. Oh, wait, story.
I just am happy to be back after a long trip, and I'm glad it's not very hot. We can talk about that later. I was dreading coming back because I thought it was going to be really hot, but it hasn't been
that hot.
It's been
pretty temperate, and even there's like a heat wave coming up that's like early 90s kind of supposedly. It hasn't been that bad.
It's not that bad, so I'm happy to be back is all.
Yeah, I was definitely feeling like this summer felt mild.
Yeah.
Like June was cold.
Right.
And May was cold.
Yeah. And July was hot, but
everywhere else.
Yeah. That's
but
right.
Not here.
Yeah.
And then the thing that blew my mind is I saw the National Weather Service tweet out that actually this summer is warmer than average for the last 3 decades.
Yes. This is our memory, which is getting warped now.
Mm-hmm.
So we think that it's mild, but it's actually hotter because our memory only goes back like 5 years.
Yeah. We've reset our reference point of what normal feels like. And it's a warmer normal than. You know, is historic for the region, but we're used to it. So now, a somewhat less warm summer actually feels like a reprieve.
But we make the same mistake here. Every year, we go off the rest of the country and we're like, oh, August is like winding up. It's like almost fall. September is just as hot as August.
That's the death
You'll
month.
Always get like into the hundreds, like just a punishing weekend
and then
in
the
September,
fires.
I feel like. And then the fire start.
Right. And then October comes and you're like seeing Halloween displays.
Right. And I'm already seeing the Halloween displays. Yeah. I don't know about you.
And then we have like 100 degree day in October. And I'm like, I'm really not feeling fall. I feel like I'm missing out. I think fall is the worst season in Los Angeles.
It is. I would say fall is the worst.
Wow.
For LA.
Something to look forward to. First bummer of the show. Thanks, Carter.
Okay. Second bummer of the show. On Tuesday, there was an election. John Lee defeated Lorraine Lundquist by 1,200 votes. Ended up being about 3 points. John Lee was a Republican running against a Democrat in a district that has about 75,000 registered Democrats compared to 40,000 registered Republicans. The Republicans in special elections vote a lot more. And actually, I think in the early ballots, there was an advantage for Democrats, but a lot of them did end up going to John Lee. He won even those early ballots. What happens now? He has to run again. First of all, he has to run in 2020.
He has to run again. Let's also go back to what we were talking about last week about this late endorsements, like last minute endorsements, like, you know, a few days before the election. Certain people never endorse, like mayor never made an endorsement. Some council members never made endorsements. But it all just seemed like very last minute for a lot of people. And it even, there is even reports that at the election result parties, the first lady and the chief of staff for the mayor were at Lorraine Lundquist's party.
Wow.
But no endorsements had been made and no support ahead of time. I mean, maybe they just you just go to these parties. But it just seemed like, if there had been a concerted effort from Democrats to try to win this election, it would have actually worked.
1,200 votes, you'd think, could have been the difference.
You'd think.
In an election with two candidates with sharply divergent views on a lot of issues, including homelessness and transit, two issues that are probably being debated more than any others in city council right now. And with a Republican candidate who has been trashing a lot of the signature initiatives of this current city council. But a lot of them sat back. Some of them endorsed him anyway.
Some of them came to council the next day and gave him a big hug and took selfies.
A lot of back slapping.
It's just so good to have another man on council. I mean, I'm just so glad that we can preserve that ratio. Thank God.
Carter, what's happening with, so John Lee campaigned against the Nordhoff, Alyssa can talk about this better than I can.
We talked before about how this was kind of a bigger statement on like BRT, bus rapid transit, because there is this project being proposed in the Valley, goes through CD12 and other districts as well. And he basically ran on this, at least in the last few weeks. He's been saying like, I will stop this project. I am against the bus, all buses maybe. What do you think, how much power would he have maybe to stop this, and how big of a deal would it be if, because Metro just announced the alignment that they want to use, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I was just reflecting on this now and thinking, you know, how many people voted in the Measure M election, you know, with this project on the ballot in 2016, you know, that the package passed with 70% approval. There must have been a couple million yes votes for a package of transit projects that included Northwest Valley BRT.
There were a couple million yes votes. In fact, there were 2.25 million yes votes.
And in this last election in CD12, there were, you know, about 50,000 votes.
Total. Yeah.
And so I wouldn't rush to overinterpret, you know, this one election changing the course of a major transit project that got into the Measure M package because there were champions and stakeholders in the Valley who said, we want our fair share of transit investment. And we have major destinations like the hospitals in Panorama City and Cal State Northridge with 40,000 students. You know, those are still voices that I think we need to hear from advocating for this project to move forward, recognizing that there's this broad support in the county to see a build out of a regional transportation system.
I love your optimism. We have a city council member who just ran on stopping this project, which is supposed to be one of the earliest ones of 28 by 28. And now he is running in another election. So I feel like at the very least, nothing is going forward on a route that he promised to like not let through until after November 2020.
Oh, I see. So he starts campaigning immediately, and then the bus, it kind of fuels the bus deniers.
He's campaigning right now. Yeah. Like, this is like, we're right back
into
it.
The campaign.
Yes.
I don't know if I can stomach this for another year.
Well, we only have one.
There's only, that's the
Scott's
only.
Scott's gone this week.
That's
so
the only
leave.
Election to worry about.
So the cool thing about this 2020 election is it's the first time LA is going to be having its municipal elections.
You're so optimistic, Carter, about everything.
It is cool. It is cool.
This is my hashtag brand. Guys, have you seen my Twitter?
Okay, but you're right. Let's talk about that for a minute because that is interesting.
Not your Twitter, the election thing.
Yes. So 2020, first time in ever, decades, LA has synced up its municipal elections with the state and federal elections. The electorate voting in those elections is going to be really different than the electorate that had voted in a March odd year election when a lot of people weren't paying attention, just because people take cues from national media. We're gearing up for election time, have to make decisions. So I think it's safe to say, you know, we'd get close to double the number of people voting in the CD12 election in 2020. And I think because Trump will be on the ballot, it's going to mobilize and skew it towards more democratic, more progressive, more transit friendly electorate that's going to come out and maybe give a signal to whoever wins that election that transit is a priority, that it needs to be designed in a way that works and serves the major job centers, and, you know, not try to nitpick the routing in a way that disadvantages the riders.
Big question, is Dr. Lundquist going to run again? She has not said anything to either effect so far, but it would seem like she is in the best position to, having already gotten her name out there, to run it back.
She technically did win the first time. So
she did. She got more votes than anyone else.
She technically already won.
Yeah. There's another story that came out on Friday, yesterday, as we are recording this, that was pretty shocking. It was a press release from the LA DA's office, from Jackie Lacey's office, saying that they have charged an Inglewood man who was connected with a series of shootings last summer, about exactly 1 year ago, with murder, attempted murder, and hate crime charges that hadn't been announced before. And I had not really heard about this.
Never heard of this
story.
Yeah.
And so I went into it, and apparently over the course of about a week, a guy named Daniel Martinez was basically terrorizing the city, driving around, shooting people from his car. He attacked 8 people, including a child. And it turns out, according to the DA's office, that he was targeting people because they were Black. He was captured by police after this week-long rampage. Allegedly, none of this has been proven in court yet. No word on how he was captured, no word on really anything about him, except that prosecutors had previously identified him as a gang member, but then withdrew that. So they were charging this as like gang violence, essentially.
Of course.
But then said, no, it wasn't that. It was racially motivated, they're saying. A lot of interesting stuff about this story. The biggest to me being that it was not really a story until, like, you know, this tweet went out from the LA Times yesterday. The press release was released on Tuesday. So it went 3 days without anyone even registering that last summer there was effectively, he meets the standard of a serial killer.
Is the news that they thought he was a gang member and now they've walked that back? Or is the news that the charges are being brought for
simultaneously, they walked back his gang member status and charged him with hate crime charges.
Okay, so it's officially a hate crime charge.
That, I think, is like the biggest news that they say he was driving around trying to murder Black people. And the other thing that I think is interesting about it is that gang charge, which in LA is very loosely applied a lot of the time, as we're kind of seeing here. Sara Suleiman actually wrote a great, very informative piece about Nipsey Hussle in Streets Blog and the work that he did both on gang injunctions and placemaking in South LA and his area where he had his marathon store. And she talks about these like gang charges and how widely applied they were and how it could lead to extra sentencing for people who were thought to be in gangs. Lots of people are in the gang database without knowing that they're in there, without ever having actually been gang members. And apparently, I was like doing more research on this. I didn't realize LAPD uses a member-based approach where a homicide is gang-related if the victim or the assailant is a gang member. So if a gang member is killed, for example, for reasons totally by a stranger, as like possibly in this case, that is technically a gang homicide.
No.
And also, like in some cases in LA, a crime could be classified as gang related if it occurs in a neighborhood where there is an ongoing rivalry.
And this is so they can justify using gang force.
Yes.
Well, and all those other things. Right. Yeah, of course.
Yes. By attributing problems to gang violence where it doesn't exist.
Right. Right.
And it seems like that was happening in this case for a year. I think it's worth looking into how this just like kind of sat in the DA's office.
Well, you
for
said
so long.
A year ago, you were talking about the breaking news of the day a year ago when this case should have been all over the headlines. And it was that West Hollywood was trying to stop Donald Trump's star from being on the Walk of Fame.
Oh, that was that story was going around yesterday.
Wait, yesterday?
It happened a year ago. But this guy, Kyle Griffin, who aggregates stories for MSNBC.
Am I getting that wrong?
No, you're not getting
that
wrong.
Story was like
the story
a year
was
ago.
A year ago. You're not getting it wrong. He tweeted out yesterday that West Hollywood had approved the initiative to get rid of finally. Donald Trump Star, which they have absolutely no authority over. It might as well be Portland, Maine deciding to get rid of Donald Trump Star.
Yeah. West Hollywood asks nicely to have Trump Star removed.
From a city that is not theirs.
And now the initiative is sent along to the city of Los Angeles and they will decide what to do with it.
Okay, so you're saying he was aggregating that news yesterday instead of
not realizing that it was
this.
A year ago. Yeah. But if we're going to be reporting on year-old stories, maybe this one about a racially motivated serial killer is worth talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this, especially with the climate of what's been going on in the last few weeks when it comes to targeting people of certain ethnicities, like especially in a place like Inglewood, where we've talked about so many changes that are happening and people being pushed out who are from the Black community mm-hmm. in Inglewood. I mean, this is a really terrifying thing if this is something that's been happening and nobody's talking about it.
Yeah, I hope we hear more. I assume the Times and other local papers are starting to dig in on it now. I heard some reporters saying that they're trying to gather more information. But yeah, really, really shocking story. Carter, did you read this thing about the City of Industry this week?
Which one?
Which article?
Yes, which article?
Which City of Industry?
So many.
Which industry? So there's a story from Jason Henry in the Pasadena Star News that I'm so glad I get to tell you about on the show. So you have to react in real time as I'm telling you this
100%
story.
100% earnest reaction.
Yes. So imagine if we talk about like engagement in the city council in LA and like local elections. Imagine if city council elections were so impactful that after, like because of an election, say the special election in CD12, a third of the population of Los Angeles moved out of the city.
What?
Was forcibly removed from the city. This happened in City of Industry.
Okay, but how many people live in the
200
city?
200 people.
Okay. And
2.5% of them are on the city council. There are it's a 5-member city council.
What would that be for LA? 2% of Angelenos on the city council?
On the city council?
That'd be some really good meetings.
Just doing the math in my head, I don't know.
I think it's like 8,000.
8,000 member right. city council. Yeah.
That's about as many people we should actually have in the city council here.
So there was a hotly contested election in industry. This is back in 2015. And we've talked about city government and corporatocracies like industry and commerce, where the city council recently beat each other up. These elections get very heated. And after the election, people say in the town that a third of the population was pushed out for supporting the wrong side because the city terminated their leases and kicked them out of the City of Industry.
Wait, they have like social housing there?
The city council controls half of the city's housing.
Well, see, now that's an idea I can get behind.
Yeah, but a real unlikely ally in the cause of just cause evictions and renter protections. I mean, the City of Industry, not on my radar for renter organizing, but maybe they should be.
They manage $1 billion in funds for 200 people. And by the way, the other half of the homes in the city, this is all from Jason Henry's article, are owned by the Perez family, who own the city's exclusive trash hauler. There are fewer than 10 residences in City of Industry that are independently owned. They don't have any residential zoning, so these houses are like tucked into factories. And
like it's people who own the factories just live there maybe, or
basically they are permitted residences, but they don't have any actual residential zoning. And there are no applications required, no proof of income. Tenants are just selected in secret and vacancies just go to friends and family. One example of these residences, the mayor at the time, Mark Radecki, lives in a 5,500 square foot house that he pays $700 a month for.
5,500
square feet.
Is it a warehouse?
That's right. It's a factory. They make koosh balls.
Cold storage.
Yeah. The city recently renovated it for $500,000. And after he forced a third of the residents of City of Industry out of the city, is said to have put friends in these now vacant units. And one of these friends is a woman named Catherine Marcucci. And she was given a city council, moved to City of Industry, get the house that you pay $700 a month for, are given a city council seat. It's pretty typical.
It comes with the house?
Comes with the house, yes. But then she started asking questions about how rental applications work, like how these houses are chosen. I don't know why she had questions, because it happened to her. She went through this process.
This sounds like a homeowner's association with police power and taxation authority. I've thought, you know, we have a lot of cities in California, and I think it's pretty clear that there are some underperformers.
They have $1 billion.
$1 billion. And, you know, what if we just relegated the bottom 5% every year? You know, they get disincorporated. Maybe the neighboring city can annex it.
Wow. Just take them out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But who wants It's just a collection of bizarre people. I mean, I don't like what city wants.
So they can kick them out of their housing if they don't. If they make too much noise,
they can terminate their lease. Yeah. After the election, they almost immediately terminated 8 households, which represented like 10% of the population right there. And after this woman, Catherine Marcucci, started asking questions, the mayor and his wife did not like that. And his wife, Mary Radecki, told Catherine Marcucci to keep your mouth shut. She said, "We gave it all to you instead of giving it to somebody else. There is a lot of people that have been brought into the city to board seats, jobs by friends of friends. Like you said, you wouldn't be in the city if it wasn't for friends. So I don't understand why, out of all of the people we've brought in, you're the only one causing problems." City, this is what LA should be. Just a city where everyone is friends with each other.
You can get in if you have a friend. Yeah, you're right. We should take away their charter. I mean, they should be the commerce fighters. I mean, we should take away these people's city charters. How does that work?
Yeah, and I guess then the city of LA or whoever would get their money.
Yeah,
but
get the industry.
Would get all that industry.
And commerce.
All that delicious industry and commerce.
Yeah, I think it's kind of an extreme example of something we see in a lot of communities in a less pronounced way, where for a lot of kind of reasons of our state tax structure, it's really incentivizing cities to pursue commercial development, which brings in, you know, head tax revenue for employees and property tax revenue and sales tax from all the money those employees spend. But they don't have to provide schools to those people, you know, just the workers in that community. And a lot of cities that have done that are not building enough housing near those jobs to, you know, mitigate the cost increases that are in the housing market. So, you know, I think Santa Monica has done some of its fair share in building housing for all the jobs that it's created. But, you know,
isn't Santa Monica's population basically frozen since like 1970 or something?
Yeah, it's been in the high 80s, low 90s thousand population for a long time. The daytime population doubles with all the people commuting in and the tourists and visitors that support the tax base that, you know, pays for all the services that we enjoy. So I've always urged Santa Monica to build more housing so people aren't stuck on the 10 freeway trying to get into town. I think there are other cities that also need to do their part. And we could talk about Culver City and Beverly Hills that are building, you know, or encouraging a lot of commercial development and not doing their fair share on housing. Certainly in the Bay Area, that's the case in Silicon Valley.
It might seem
this is our future,
right?
City of industry.
I mean, residential development doesn't have exactly those same incentives as commercial development because the city or state doesn't make as much in taxes off of residential development because of Prop 13. Is that
right? Yeah. Everyone's home property values are frozen whenever they bought it with a small escalator of 2% per year. And that's just devastated the ability of cities to provide services and maintain infrastructure for the residents that they're accommodating. So
silver lining, 2020 election.
Split roll.
Are
we going to split it?
They did just have to, they're refreshing the split roll effort, right? They took the old initiative off the books, and now they're doing a new one, which is more generous to small businesses. Is that correct?
Mm. I've seen various comments about it, but I don't know enough about how it's changing. Maybe you know, Carter. They named it something really good. Isn't it like families and schools or something like that?
That's what they're all called. Every single one is called something about families and schools.
The idea, I think, is to, reassess the commercial property values every year, unlike under Prop 13 now, where it's only when a property changes hands. But if it's a commercial business, it like never changes hands. Like a shell company buys a shell company.
Yeah.
And legally, no one's ever changed more than 50% of the ownership. And so, you know, you have like golf courses that, you know, are paying property taxes based on what they were assessed in 1970, on the west side of LA County, that should be worth millions and millions of dollars if they were used to build housing and, you know, jobs, but are taxed as if they're worth $1 million for hundreds of acres of land.
But they're restarting that campaign, I think, because labor has now gotten on board in a more pronounced way to advocate for split roll, to allow commercial property taxes to increase. But the fact that they did have to change some of the terms of it means that they do have to get all their signatures again. They have to get way more signatures than they did the first time, I believe, because it's based on turnout from the 2018 election now, which is much higher. So it'll be a lot more expensive, but with that labor money.
Okay, yeah, you're right. On August 13th, there was an amendment, and it's kind of been reformulated in a way. You're exactly right. So that did just happen.
That favors small business.
Yeah, it just tweaks it a little bit, but right. I think the idea is the same. But I want to make sure I get the name right. What's it called? Families and schools or something?
Families
so
and schools
can
or
follow
something.
It. They're already doing like canvassing and stuff. So I wanted to make sure I get it right.
Yeah, I think Californians have a really clear sense that schools have been underfunded since Prop 13 passed. And we see, you know, huge commercial operations paying really low property tax while our schools are being starved for funding on a, you know, per capita, per student level that, you know, puts us really disfavorably with some states that are, you know, much poorer than California. So
like Mississippi.
Yeah, we're in the company of Mississippi and Louisiana and you know, places that as affluent as California really can do so much better.
Okay, so what it's called, what the split role, no one would say split role, I guess. People would look at you like you weren't saying something weird, but it's called...
Sounds like a sushi item.
Schools and Communities First. It's the Schools and Communities First campaign. A powerful coalition of grassroots orgs working to restore $11 billion per year to California's schools and community services.
Wow,
that's a good way to frame it, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
Schoolsandcommunitiesfirst.org.
If you pitch it as closing a corporate loophole for property taxes, I think people will be on board.
And
for commercial property taxes, for big businesses.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of incentivizing commercial development, former head of city planning, Michael LeGrand, he leaves his job in 2016, leaves City Hall. And there's a rule that says you are not allowed to lobby until you're 12 months out the door. You take a long vacation and then, you know, you're back in business.
So, for example, our CD12 city council person,
yes.
Same.
John Lee.
No. Our old, the
Mitch
one.
Englander.
Who left,
our
Mitch
old
Englander.
One.
So Mitch Englander left to become a lobbyist, but he can't actively lobby the government for a year. Right?
Yes. Yeah. He is actually, I believe, allowed to be paid by a lobbying firm,
yes.
Which, correct me if I'm wrong, he probably is at this moment.
Right.
But that's an investment on future lobbying. Yeah. That,
just giving some examples from prior
shows. That he can do in a few months.
And I can speak to this just from personal experience, having worked at the city.
As a lobbyist? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah, I think basically it's, you know, if you work for an agency, you know, the year after you leave, you can't attempt to influence decisions by that agency and be compensated for it.
But imagine just sitting at home and you're just seeing, I mean, the temptation.
It's like, oh, I could really get
something done. Tens of thousands of dollars.
You could lobby anyone else.
Anyone but the city of LA?
The city of industry, perhaps.
Yeah, it depends on the specific ethics language.
But what if someplace as cool as Soho House comes to you? And it's like, wow, you're the former head of city planning. You could probably help us get our new downtown Soho House through City Hall without getting a zone change. We'll give you $70,000. You're gonna wait like 9 more months to get that opportunity? Or are you going to do it after 3 months like Michael LeGrand did and got caught for and is now being fined $218,000, the largest fine in the history of the
revolving door. Totally worth it. Totally worth it.
Right?
How much is Soho House paying? But this was a project that, you know, so Soho House has a West Hollywood location on Sunset and they're trying to open one in the Arts District. It's been such a long journey for them because I think the building needed a zoning change. And for some reason, the building was not determined to need a zoning change. And now we know why.
Now we know why.
So what he basically asked for them to not have to change the zoning.
Yeah.
And the project moved forward.
Asked all his friends. His former employees.
They're probably friends.
Sure.
So he's getting fined. That's an astronomical amount of money. I mean,
that's
we've
a
seen
lot.
A few of these come through in the last few years, especially related to planning and other people who are paying money. We had some planning commission drama. We've had some FBI investigations that have to do with the planning commission. I mean, we had some with the planning department. Sorry.
Uh-huh.
We've had some interesting planning.
It's been an active business over the last couple of years.
I would say having worked at the city with 40,000 other people, working at the city of Los Angeles, you know, the vast majority, almost everyone is in it for the right reasons and, you know, is driven by the mission of public service. And that was something that I found, you know, extremely energizing every day coming to City Hall was the opportunity to serve in the public interest with the trust of the public. So I find it very...
Do you know which ones aren't?
Can you give us a list?
I find it hard to relate to seeing some people make some decisions where they kind of failed the public trust. But, you know, I appreciate that the Ethics Commission is there to have this check and accountability mechanism to make sure, you know, because at the end of the day, we're trying as a city to do all these really important things, energy, transportation, health, recreation. And, that only works if the public trusts that we're in it for the right reasons.
And this is a good deterrent. It's a huge amount of money, like you were saying. What seems like would be a better deterrent is changing how arbitrary our planning rules are, how it basically is up to a handful of people to like flip a coin to see whether or not people get these things like zone changes.
And for Soho House, like, I'm right. sorry, but like maybe if it was for like an affordable housing complex.
I wouldn't say maybe. I would say in almost every case.
Do you
think
he got his Soho House membership taken away for this?
Oh, God. That brutal. And that's worth
that millions.
Priceless. Yes.
What I think is so exciting about the transit-oriented communities program that LA launched a couple of years ago that's building a ton of deed-restricted affordable housing is that it is a process that is really transparent. And developers can come to the city and they can ask for certain density bonuses. And there's a very clear amount of affordable housing that they have to provide in order to gain those bonuses. And it's all based on a menu of options the developer can pick from. And then the housing gets built. And it removes and somewhat depoliticizes the process of building affordable housing.
Just for that bonus, though, I mean, there are still, to get the actual project built in every case, there are so many checks that you have to go through in City Hall, so many gatekeepers that have to make decisions on each of these structures getting built. And the result to me, so I saw Shane Phillips posting the other day that between 2014 and 2016, 7% of projects in LA were by right. Everything else has to go through discretionary committees that are exactly that. It's just the discretion of these individuals to get
something. That's because we do need the zoning changes in many cases because everything was zoned to be a strip mall or, right. you know, something. We do need the exceptions, but you're right.
But without these good plans, stuff takes longer to get built. Right. Rents are higher.
That's it's the community plans that need to be changed and made, you know.
And that's how this corruption happens. I mean, what if you're like a small builder or like an affordable builder, how do you navigate this system if you don't
become a member at the Soho House?
That's right.
Clearly.
Alyssa, what's going on? And the saga continues between Amoeba and
speaking of planning. Yeah. So we remember last we were talking about
a couple weeks ago,
AHF, AIDS Healthcare Foundation, had attempted to bring about this case to make Amoeba a historic cultural landmark monument to protect the building, the 18-year-old building, from being turned into a 26-floor high-rise. And it was weird because we never really heard from Amoeba at the time. Mm-hmm. We knew that they were trying to move to a new location. They had been doing it for years. They had sold their building. They had made a lot of money selling their building to this developer, which had kept the business alive in a time of great tumult in the music industry. And finally, we've heard from Amoeba. So one of the co-owners, Jim Henderson, finally put out a statement, which was scathing, I feel like.
We didn't really talk about this. I mean, they must have really freaked out. It jeopardizes their sale of their building.
So they're trying to move to this new location. And they had apparently one place secured. It's a giant store. It needs to have a giant space, which could be complicated if you were trying to find. They wanted to stay in Hollywood. Apparently they found a place. It fell through. They're looking for another place. And now you're going to try to find these spaces. And they're saying, hey, aren't you trying to stay in your building? Aren't you trying to landmark it? And they're like, no, we're not trying to do that. Well, so they made the statement that's saying, like, they literally said, back away. You're making this harder for us to stay in business.
It reminds me of what was just going down in Manhattan with the Strand bookstore. That was, it's in the Village, I believe. And it's a bookstore that's been operating for decades and decades. And some activists in the neighborhood advocated for it to be designated a historic landmark against the wishes of the Strand's owners and operators because they felt like that was going to tie their hands and add complexity and cost to any kind of building renovations or modifications that they were going to do at a time when they are competing against Amazon to stay relevant and stay operating as a brick and mortar bookstore.
I said, please, please don't give us monument status. And they lost. I want to read one of Scott's tweets that really made me laugh. Like he's here. This is in the form of a dialogue piece. Amoeba says, we've beaten the odds in a dying industry by selling our building to secure millions of capital. Michael Weinstein, look, I'm on your side. I just want you to stay where you are, give up all that money, and go out of business.
So that's what was so, this was the funniest press release to get. You know, there was a statement sent from Amoeba, which it was great to hear that they were actually not wanting to have their building saved. Also, they want, the biggest argument in the you know, the application to make it a monument was to save the neon. They're like, it's actually harder for us to plan to move the neon, which we're trying to do, mm-hmm. if you're trying to say that it should stay in place. So the I've never seen a press release like this. Amoeba sent out a statement, and then AHF sent a statement that like annotated the Amoeba statement.
Yeah, so it was equally scathing. So now these two entities are at war.
But I think this was the funniest part of the statement, which nobody really wrote about. But so Amoeba says, when we, and I feel like we should have some Paul McCartney music like playing in the background, maybe like, the store is mine.
Okay, I don't know if we're going to put together a song parody, but we could maybe do an instrumental.
The goddamn store is mine. When we sold our building in 2015 to GPI, that's the developers they sold it to, for $34 million, we did so to protect Amoeba from going in the direction of so many other physical retailers and to preserve the jobs of the nearly 400 amazing people currently employed by Amoeba. Michael Weinstein. They sold the property for a whopping $34 million. Undoubtedly a killing compared to the price they paid 20 years ago. It is highly unlikely that they are sharing any of this king's ransom with the 400 employees they claim to care so much about. So they should have divided it. Is what he's trying to say, that they should have divided $34 million?
I mean, I assume a lot of it is being invested in keeping a store alive.
Moving to a new location.
Yeah, and an industry.
Store on the run.
Yes, that's good. Store on the run. That's right.
I mean,
so this is the great track changes war of 2019.
Really, and then the other thing later in the, you know, again, he said it's making it harder for us to do this, especially when you're not stopping any of the other developments that are happening around us. I mean, maybe they've stopped the development of a building that they have tried to move to. They were like, oh, we're going to build this new retail space, and they've fought that. But he said, again, AHF Michael Weinstein, the fact that Hollywood is being gentrified at a dizzying rate by multiple mega developments, many of which we are also opposing, is not a justification for one more unnecessary luxury high rise. We are fighting for the integrity of our community and to preserve what makes it interesting, whereas it seems like many others are just trying to cash out and milk it for everything it's worth. So he's basically saying he doesn't want Amoeba to make money or survive.
Well,
just
he
the
tried
shell
to help
of the
them,
building.
But they went after him. So, and meanwhile, he got a huge win, I think, in stopping the origin building of this entire campaign, which is right next to him behind the concert venue. What's it called? Help me.
Palladium.
Yes, the Palladium Towers. They just won a lawsuit to at least delay it for a long time now. I mean, this was the thing that got Measure S started in the first place. That's like with years and years in the making. But he doesn't, he refuses to rest on his laurels. He lives in the studio. Carter, let's get into it on emissions. Alyssa, you take the wheel.
Well, I won't. I will get on the
bus. Take the scooter handlebars.
I will not take the wheel. So we like to check in every once in a while with when these Air Resources Board reports come out, because I think sometimes they get picked up really well. This is CARB, maybe, if you would say it from a acronym. They release these reports every year about how we're doing with emissions for the state of California. And sometimes I feel like they get picked up really well and the news is shared in a way that gives a sense of urgency to what we're facing. But I didn't feel like this week's report was, I don't know, delivered with a sense of urgency. Maybe we have other things to worry about at the moment.
Yeah. So CARB came out with a report showing that California's economy continues to grow. Population is increasing. And yet carbon emissions are falling, both in an absolute and on a per capita basis.
Great news.
The news is good. What's the opposite of a silver lining?
A pewter.
The sad trombone
shell.
In the release was that the progress is being made in spite of lack of progress in the transportation sector. And that's really where I plug in for the Natural Resources Defense Council. My job is to, you know, help get projects implemented and pass laws that reduce emissions from the transportation sector, particularly by reducing the amount of driving that's happening in California.
Which is the largest contributor to our transportation emissions, I assume, single occupancy vehicles.
Yeah, single occupancy vehicles are the lion's share of transportation emissions, and transportation emissions are the largest contributor to carbon emissions in California and now in the US. So we really are not going to get to our goals unless we both clean the fleet of vehicles that are out there on the streets, but we also simultaneously have to reduce the total number of cars and driving that's happening in California. And we can't get to where we need to go without doing both at the same time. So says CARB, our climate regulator.
Where do we make improvements?
So, you know, it's two things simultaneously. It's like these dimensions of how much driving is happening and the dimension of how clean is that fleet. And so you clean the fleet by more aggressively encouraging the adoption of electric vehicles and high fuel efficiency vehicles. That's the one dimension. The other is we need to reduce the total number of driving, even as those vehicles get cleaner. And that means transit projects. It means housing near jobs where you don't need to drive as far just to get to your daily errands. It means protected bike lanes and pedestrian crosswalks, the whole kit of parts of building livable, healthy cities where you don't need a car for every single trip that you have to take.
That answers a question that was probably a better one that I should have asked. What I did ask was, where did we make improvements? I think that's where do we make improvements? That's, but where did we over the last like measuring period?
So where we continue to make improvement, it seems to be, is in the power sector.
Okay.
So you flip the lights on, electricity is coming in, and that electricity is getting cleaner and cleaner. We were helped a lot by a really wet winter of 2017, 18. That meant we were producing a lot of hydropower. But we're also building and bringing online more solar and wind that is allowing us to reduce natural gas and imports of coal and other fossil fuel sources. So the grid is getting cleaner, but the grid is only, I think, around a quarter of the carbon emissions in California.
So we talk about this a lot locally, right? We have, is it the same type of breakdown when it comes, and we'll say, and I know it's not measured as specifically, but say in the LA region, is it the same problem as this, well, or solution at this, as the state figures?
Yeah, it varies from city to city, but typically transportation emissions plus building energy usage is about half or more than half of all the energy used in cities. And the rest would be like industrial manufacturing, oil production, you know, freight, you know, sort of heavy industry type things. I know in Santa Monica, transportation is 2/3 of the carbon emissions in the city.
Wow.
It's probably going to grow because Santa Monica is now procuring 100% renewable energy. But, you know, for, I think in Los Angeles, you know, transportation is still a huge source of carbon emissions. And it's a sector we can't ignore if we're going to hit our climate goals. And so if you look at the sustainability plan, there's a number of measures in there that are geared towards increasing transit ridership, uptake of electric vehicles, bike and pedestrian utilization. So I think we know what we need to do. And now is the matter of...
But do we actually know what we need to do? Because it seems like we had this Green New Deal. I mean, that was announced, the sustainability plan that you're talking about, right? So it's like, it's out there and we have these goals that we are supposed to hit by like 2021, 2025, 2030, right? And how do we even know? I mean, it seems like those goals aren't even, I can't see like without like say dedicated bus lanes, like very simple things. You see like these ideas floated and then nothing really seems to happen. So like, how do we stay on target to make sure that this actually, what could move the needle enough within the next year, say?
So I think the things that will continue to move the needle are things like dedicated bus lanes, like the good projects in Measure M. We all need to stay vigilant and engaged to make sure those projects get delivered. You know, I think there's work underway to build out bike and pedestrian infrastructure. It's perhaps not as fast as some of the LA podcast listeners would like, but you know, I think there's work being done to move this forward. And LA is such a big part of the state of California that I think, you know, LA needs to do its part, and it's getting there.
I mean, when you go to Santa Monica, where you are, you really do see a physical change in the streets. Like you, when I ride my bike around there or when I take the train there, and you see literally streets changing, like sidewalks being widened and crosswalks being put in that make the pedestrian feel like they might be prioritized just a little bit. Bike lanes are going in, protected bike lanes. You know, it really is a market improvement within the last few years. Is that, do you think, changing behavior enough within the city of Santa Monica? You said that it's 2/3 of emissions, but that's actually kind of what you want it to be as power goes down and then we tackle transportation. And it doesn't mean that it's like more people are driving, but then you have all the people driving into the city of Santa Monica because you said they don't have enough, there's not enough housing and there's so much, you know, too many jobs. So how are we actually changing behavior, and can we look to Santa Monica for being that kind of model?
I think Santa Monica still has a ways to go. I would say it has engaged really productively with the dockless scooter tech overlords to make sure this rollout serves the community well, with just another layer of sustainable mobility. It basically cornered the market on green paint by painting, you know, dozens and dozens of green bike lanes in Santa Monica. And I think that's given kind of a 20,000 foot signal to people driving in the community that this is a community that has a big network of bike lanes. You have to be alert to, you know, people in the bike lanes on scooters and on their own bikes. I have definitely still run into people parked in the bike lane because not all of the lanes are protected yet.
On a bike. I just want to make clear that not in your car.
Yes, I have encountered while biking cars parked in the bike lane. And we need to do more in Santa Monica to protect those lanes with physical separation so that people of all ages and abilities feel safe riding in Santa Monica. But that's, I think, a really big and good first move. And now the ante has been raised.
I have an air quality question.
Go.
So I saw, Carter, you were just posting about we've had 54 straight dirty air days in the South Coast region, the one that we live in. I check my little iPhone weather app every like 20 minutes to see if I'm safe to be outside. And once it gets over level 100 or whatever, now we're in like unhealthy for sensitive groups territory. Past 150, I think it's unhealthy. There have been a lot of days in the past like couple weeks that have been like good or moderate air days, it says on the app. But those still qualify, it seems like, as dirty air days, according to the South Coast air quality, whatever it is. So what does that mean? Like, is our standard for what is breathable air like off compared to what it should be?
So I think the South Coast Air Quality Management District's reporting is based off of federal standards of how much ground level ozone and like particulate matter. So like the tiny microscopic soot from trucks and tires that is so small, it basically just like goes into your lungs and dissolves into your bloodstream.
Yeah. It's an important thing that I forget if we've talked about, but I've been telling a lot of people that so much of it comes from tires, not from tailpipe emissions. Those little particles.
Tires and brake pads and other things that just...
Which is why electric vehicles aren't really going to solve all of the problems.
Right.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, I sometimes look at the iPhone weather app and I think, you know, I feel like the air is worse than you're leading me to believe. And so I double check it against some other sources like Purple Air. I actually just bought an air sensor off the internet yesterday because I felt like I wanted to have better information about how conditions really were at a very local level for me. I live about 1,000 feet from the 10 freeway and know that by being that close, I'm probably at a greater risk of exposure to air pollution. And, you know, how many Angelinos live within 1,000 feet of a freeway? It's quite a lot. So,
and the major boulevards can be just as bad depending on how many cars are on them.
Tens of thousands of cars a day.
So you'd think, and this is also something that we've discussed and is part of the Green New Deal, is this idea that we should get to, they actually changed it. They said we were going to have like zero unhealthy air days and they kind of revised it because they couldn't quite promise that by a certain timeline. So you'd think that even if the climate thing seemed too far away for people to get too worried about, although after the summer, I feel like everyone is more worried than they were before, the air quality thing, right? So Ciclovia is happening tomorrow. We're recording this on Saturday, which has demonstrated, there's been so many studies done that have showed just like taking the cars off even just a single road has so many demonstrated health benefits, including this particulate matter that we've been talking about. Dramatic improvements. Would you think that the air quality thing might be enough to have these kind of spare the air days like they have in Northern California? Why don't we have anything like that in Southern California?
It seems like a real opportunity to mobilize Angelinos here. You know, my parents grew up in LA in the 40s and 50s. My mom in the San Gabriel Valley in Sierra Madre, where there were bad air days where you were kind of locked in the house and schools were closed and you couldn't see the San Gabriel Mountains 5 miles away.
I feel like that's happening again, though, right? I mean, doesn't it seem that bad again?
Right. And we made a tremendous amount of progress primarily relying on technology. The catalytic converter at the end of every tailpipe really helped reduce certain types of pollutants. But LA has continued to grow. Driving has continued to increase, I think, at a faster rate than population. And so we're now back, I think, not where we started, but back in a place where we can't rely just on technology to bail us out. We need to, you know, rely on all the things that will help people drive, you know, drive less, take transit more, bike and walk. And I think this is a moment where Angelinos are ready to be called on to take action for the collective benefit of our community and our lungs and our kids' lungs. And I think this is a moment where we all need to start speaking up about air quality and its nexus with climate. I mean, they are interrelated because as LA warms up, our air pollution problems are going to get worse because heat is a factor in local air pollution. So, you know, I think this is a moment where we need to seize on that to really draw the connection between, say, a bus rapid transit project in the valley to the air that we breathe and the climate that we're going to leave the next generation.
So quick idea. Let me run this by you.
Hit me.
Once those numbers, whatever, on whatever app we use, gets to that point, unhealthy air quality for sensitive groups, my kids, free transit across the region.
I love it.
Until it gets better.
Sign me up.
You're in.
I'm in.
All right. Let's do it.
It's done. Carter, thank you so much for coming on the show. I have one more story I want to close with. There were a couple police shootings this week, or officer-involved shootings, as they're called. But one of the shootings was in Venice, near you, Carter, a homeless man who was said to be having like some kind of screaming and maybe having some kind of episode. Police came, and something about the reporting kind of struck me. They say that they tried to de-escalate the situation by shooting him with a taser, which didn't work. And then when that didn't work, they shot him 3 times. And he was not killed, but was injured, I believe, is still in the hospital. Man named, is identified as John. The idea that, like, this is our standard for de-escalation in this city, sending a helicopter, a low-flying helicopter, bunch of sirens, multiple officers to shoot somebody with a weapon who is screaming but not, like, threatening anybody. And they said also didn't advance on the officers or anything. I think he was holding a board at some point and was like maybe rummaging through his stuff. And so in case he was getting a gun or whatever, they decided to shoot him. Like, we just need different standards for what amounts to an escalation in this city. And I believe in places like, I think Denver is actually piloting one of the big programs to send a team of experienced case managers and like social workers who know how to communicate with somebody.
Isn't that what we are supposed to be doing in this city? Isn't that kind of the point of these care teams or whatever that we have out there, right?
But the care teams always have at least a few cops.
I know, but yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, besides that part, but shouldn't this be part of our mental health?
Yeah, and I think it is more and more. Team? Like, you know, I've actually seen some people take pictures of the mental health van that shows up. I mean, it's crazy because in some cases this would be considered like a dystopian thing. You're screaming on the street and a van comes up and throws you inside. But compared to what is currently on offer, that's
getting shot.
Yes, that seems like a really preferable option. Carter, thank you. Any parting words?
Have an amazing Ciclo Via. The Hollywoods are going to meet each other.
It was yesterday at the time where, but to us.
Yes. Hope we thank all you. Had. This yeah. is my
the Hollywoods will finally meet. The yes. war between the Hollywoods is over at last.
Reflect on what an amazing Ciclo Via you had yesterday. And think that, you know, in the not too distant future, we could have this every weekend.
Or Hollywood or streets, at least could be closed.
Streets every day yeah. that were dedicated to non-carbon polluting transportation.
This is dangerous, though. This will give West Hollywood access to the Trump star. They technically have authority of it.
They're going
to
be like camped out. They're going to annex it. They're going to be like, they draw a little gerrymandered line around it.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week on LA Podcast. Bye-bye.